From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Today on the program, a series of reports on gun violence looks at why it's occurring and what might be done at the neighborhood level. Later, a literary magazine tries to connect writers around the Great Lakes region.
I don't think about Great Lakes Review as talking about a kind of style of writing so much as it acts as a gathering place for writers in the region, and there's a cumulative sort of vision, I think, that comes as the magazine continues to publish issues.
And we'll explore Wisconsin native Rebecca Rasmussen's new novel of the North Woods, Evergreen.
My summers up north in northern Wisconsin around Eagle River shaped absolutely who I am. And I kept being drawn back and back and back to the woods and the smells and the sounds.
Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tike. Thanks so much for tuning in today. The news seemingly each day this summer has been filled with reports of gun violence and its aftermath. Fatal and non-fatal shootings get plenty of headlines, but what isn't covered as regularly is the aftermath of that violence, how it affects the victims, their families, and the community at large. There are also people and organizations working to make change. Those undertold stories have been featured recently in a series of reports in the online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. Reporter Karen Slattery joins us in the studio. Reporter Andrea Waxman joins us by phone from British Columbia this morning. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mitch. Happy to be here.
Let me ask you both if you might be able to do this. Can you quantify the current situation for us? For all the talk of gun violence today, how do things compare in Milwaukee this year to the recent past?
I have some statistics that I got recently from the Milwaukee Homicide Review Commission. My statistics are about gun homicides and injuries among children 17 and under. And Dr. O'Brien, the director there, said that while fatal shootings are actually down this year, non-fatal shootings in that age group are up 46% from 26 last year to 38 as of mid-July.
And so for the anecdotal talk, there is data to back this up, that this has been a pretty violent period in terms of the use of guns that's backed up by data.
Yes, that's correct.
Now, you have both talked with a variety of people at a variety of levels, so just regular people trying to live their lives with a prospect of violence around them, community organizers and leaders and legislative leaders. What are the theories as to why this is such a problem at this point in time?
Well, I think there are a range of problems that all sort of feed into this. And to listen to the people in the neighborhoods talk, the problems can range from issues at the policy level that need to be changed, lack of jobs for people, children not having role models, that sort of thing. So it's not any one problem. It's across the board.
And I know there have been several people quoted who, you know, talk about violence for quite some time. I know one person was talking about seeing I can't remember if there was a student or a relative shot to death in 1998. So this is not a problem that has started happening overnight in Milwaukee.
No, it hasn't. And I think what's interesting about the stories that we're covering is that we see that people are taking a look at what they can do at a very individual level, a grassroots level. In other words, instead of waiting for politicians to solve the problem or police to do something about it, they're asking, what can we do in order to make things safer for everyone?
And I want to get to some of those ideas. But before we do, Andrea Waxman, there are the obvious victims in this story, the people who are killed or wounded, and then the others around them, the friends and family members. But what do people see as the collateral damage to the communities that you cover? Maybe both of you. What are people seeing as the broader impact on the community?
I think that one thing I have been hearing at some of the gatherings that I've been to is talk of how the trauma of witnessing these crimes is affecting young people in particular, and the lack of kind of psychological services to help with that. There is one audio piece that I have in one of my stories where a teacher talks about a particular incident in which her students came out of school and saw a shooting victim just lying there in front of the school.
This just happened just before school let out on 37th at Hampton. And he was laying in the street, shot, wasn't covered up in anything. So when my students got out of school, they all went over there, and he was still laying there. And so my problem is with all the violence in our community, whenever something happened and they witness or they tonight at night they can't sleep because the shooting is going on constantly and everything, there's no services provided for them, no psychological service, because they need it just like everybody else.
And it sounds like one of the issues is there's a fear that the more this happens, the more it just seems like the norm. It becomes sort of integrated into the community.
It does. And I think that that's part of the reason that people are stepping up and trying to figure out how to resolve the issue. Let's turn it around is you know, what I'm hearing.
Well, and so how do they start unwrapping this issue? Who's coming together to make change?
Well, I recently attended a community conversation that was called by Senator Nikia Harris-Dodd at the Park Lawn YMCA, and she just wanted to give people an opportunity to discuss mostly solutions on a kind of an immediate level and possibly later on a more long-term level. But she recently had more than 50 people come together just by invitation from her, anyone in the community, and they came up with quite a few suggestions of things people could do right this minute, such as promoting neighborhood walks and community dinners to reduce residents' fears and try to build some relationships among neighbors, finding bullets in your house and getting rid of them or not allowing them in, engaging with young people in the community by helping them or just befriending them.
Well, and one of the things that's striking about this is a meeting called by a state senator, but these potential solutions are far more rapid than policy-based solutions.
Exactly. That was what they were trying to do in this particular meeting, is to see what we could do right now in our homes, in our communities.
Do you get the sense, though, that that people are looking at policy issues as well? Are there long-term policy changes that people would like to see take place?
Well, I think there are certainly issues related to guns, weapons, who has access to them is an issue that I was hearing the people there would like addressed. Jobs for people is huge. You know, how do we rebuild the economy in these areas and make sure people have employment.
Well, and along those lines, Andrea, I know one of the stories in this series of reports focused on the work of Andre Ellis. And so tell us, what is he doing and how does he fit in this whole picture?
Well, Andre Lee Ellis is a very interesting man. I would say he's probably in his late 50s. He lives at the corner of 9th and Ring. He's a playwright, and he has a particular charisma with young people, I think. And since he moved into the neighborhood, he's been watching young people and connecting with them. And this summer, he started a program that he is just completely his own grassroots effort called We've Got This. And he is inviting young men and boys in the neighborhood to come and work with him in the garden and work in the neighborhood to clean up. And he's paying them. And this has been growing and growing, and he's been calling on the Black community, starting with his friends and neighbors, but now through social media to the wider community, to contribute to pay these young men and to help them focus on developing their futures.
And this is not a program that's very formal. They're not out there. He's not out there seeking grant money. It's really directly make a donation, and this goes directly back in the hands of the kids he's hiring.
That's true. And I have to say I am seeing that. I'm seeing a desire to actually jump in and do something immediate. And I know the policy is important, and the people in the community know that too, but I think they don't want to wait for that. They want to step in and start to take control. And I've seen that at every one of these events I've been to. And Andre Lee Ellis is the epitome of that.
As you say, there have been a lot of these kinds of events, or a number of them anyway. Do you find that this issue is something that is on the radar screen of people besides those who have personally been affected? Are these kinds of events drawing more people than just in those particular neighborhoods?
I think so. I think they're going a little bit beyond. Senator Harris Dodd noted in particular that there was a lot of diversity at the meeting, the community conversation, she called. People of different ages and socioeconomic levels and races. But it doesn't go too far out of the city, I think, the awareness of it.
Karen Slattery, is that what you're finding as well?
I'm finding that it attracts people primarily from the neighborhoods, but those are passionate people about resolving this issue. I wanted to add that the one I was at was basically called by Earl Ingram, a former talk show host in Milwaukee, and James Causey, people who can invite people in and say, let's talk about this.
There have also been some other efforts that the Neighborhood News Service has written about to call attention. There was the march across the Grappi Bridge, the cloth memorials that were on display during one of those gatherings. Do people look at those as part of the solution, or really a catalyst for getting the solution kickstarted, if you will?
I think probably a little bit of both. Day Hill, who was at the Bridge Project Milwaukee March, talked about how we start small and we pull in like-minded people, and then people want to be part of something bigger. So it's a way of creating, I think, a mindset, and so it's part impetus, it's part process.
Well, it's part of something that we'll all be keeping a close eye on. Karen Slattery and Andrea Waxman, thank you so much for giving us a snapshot of your reporting.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Karen Slattery is on the faculty at the Diedrich College of Communication at Marquette University. She has been reporting for the online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service during her sabbatical. Andrea Waxman is a reporter from the Neighborhood News Service as well. She joined us by phone. You'll find a link to the news service's coverage of gun violence in Milwaukee at WUWM.com/Lake Effect. A quick break now, and in just a moment, a literary magazine specializing in work from around the Great Lakes hits the road and visits Milwaukee this week. We'll meet two of the editors when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Even in an increasingly digital world, there is still a place for a physical magazine, the printed page. 2 years ago, a group of writers and editors from around the Great Lakes region pooled their resources to found a new literary journal. The Great Lakes Review actually began in Ohio through the efforts of Rob Jackson, but the magazine, which comes out twice a year now, encompasses editors and writers from the U.S. and Canada. This summer, the magazine is on the road for events in all the places where they have editors, such as Toronto, Chicago, Buffalo, and Milwaukee. They'll be in town on Monday for an event at the Art Bar showcasing local authors and poets. David Bowen is the magazine's Milwaukee-based editor, and Ellen Jaffe is the editor based in Hamilton, Ontario. Bowen tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North more about the journal's mission.
It began as a project with Rob Jackson and the Megan Hart brothers, Dave and I think Bill in Cleveland. And they had a vision for a magazine that was going to be interested in Great Lakes writers and Great Lakes writing and the Great Lakes region in general.
Now, I'm a Canadian, so the idea really is to see the Great Lakes as an area, which includes both the U.S. and Canada. And I'm in an interesting position because I grew up not in the Great Lakes area, but in New York, but I've been in Canada for about 30 years in Ontario, so around the Great Lakes. So what drew me, a friend of mine told me about the magazine and said, you know, was I interested in contributing? So So I sent in a poem about Lake Erie and some other poems. And when I saw the magazine, I was so impressed by the professionalism and the beauty of it. And it's about 250 pages, and it's got a beautiful cover. You know, it's well done. And also by the range of writing, by writers from all over, you know, Cleveland, Buffalo, Hamilton, Toronto, Milwaukee, Chicago. So it really connects people in a very vital way. There's a lot of energy there.
Is there a Great Lakes style? Is there something about being here that would define someone as a Great Lakes writer?
You know, I'm not sure. I think the styles are different. I think it's always that way. Are you a... The writing doesn't have to be about the Great Lakes, as I've noticed. You know, some of the things that either I've contributed or many other people. There's sort of a zeitgeist. There's a sense you get from living in an area.
I don't think about Great Lakes Review as talking about a kind of style of writing so much as a, like it acts as a gathering place for writers in the region, and there's a cumulative sort of vision, I think, that comes as the magazine continues to publish issues.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, that it kind of creates a momentum. And I was thinking how the Great Lakes, you know, are trade. I mean, they're lakes, they're water, they deal with nature, with, you know, possibly with pollution, but with trading. And now we're trading in words and culture.
One of the things I was thinking of is that we run into this in Milwaukee all the time, and I don't know if that's true in Hamilton where you are, Ellen, but it's the third coast. You know, we have the West Coast and the East Coast, which are, quote unquote, the important cultural coasts. And then you've got this sort of amorphous middle where some good stuff happens, but it doesn't seem to have – it doesn't toot its own horn very well in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if this review is a way to kind of highlight people who are living and working in this – it's a big region. I mean, the Great Lakes take up a lot of space. So it's not like we're just talking about Milwaukee or just talking about Hamilton. You know, but we're talking about this big swath of territory with all of these really good writers who may not get the same attention as if they were from New York or Los Angeles or even Toronto.
And I think that's a good thing, and it's certainly for Hamilton, because we're kind of a, you know, poor second cousin of Toronto, and people say, oh, it's a steel city. But there are a lot of actually really good writers in Hamilton, and a lot of people from Toronto are moving to Hamilton because of rents, and it's creating an arts community. So I think this is, it's part of also a working class. I think the whole Great Lakes area has a sort of a working class ethic, and I think that is one of the things that comes out in the writing.
David, would you agree?
Yeah, first to the point of kind of a blue-collar vision of life. I think that Milwaukee is a very blue-collar town. I think Chicago, Cleveland. In the first issue, we had Anthony Bukuski in the first issue. He's up in Superior, and he writes a lot about the Polish population living up in Superior, Wisconsin. I think we have a lot of – we have an industrial past that I think kind of gets unearthed in the work that gets published at Great Lakes Review. But I don't think that's only what the magazine does.
No, it's certainly not only. And I was going to say, too, we've got a variety of stuff, types of writing. There's fiction, there's poetry, there's drama, which in very few magazines include drama.
I want to talk a little bit about your process of choosing what you publish. How does that work? Do you all look at things, the entire committee?
We do. The way that it's worked since the beginning, we have these different editorial bases. It began with Milwaukee and Chicago and Cleveland, Buffalo and Toronto, and we're expanding. We now have editors in Detroit, Ellen in Hamilton. And the way that it began was that editors in one city, Milwaukee, for instance, was reading submissions from Toronto. So nobody was necessarily reading their friend's stuff. So it was somewhat more objective, I think, was the idea at the beginning.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that's actually a good thing because, first of all, then as editors, we get to know writers from other cities. Yeah, and I've been quite impressed by the kinds of things that are submitted.
Yeah, and I think getting to know writers from the region is a big part of what the magazine wants to do. And it wants to introduce readers, too, to writers from other places that are nearby. I really like the idea of thinking about a literary magazine as a gathering point, as a place for people to meet from different places and to exchange ideas and to meet each other.
One of the things I find interesting is that you actually publish a physical copy of the magazine. In our digital world, everybody seems to be going to the web, and everybody says, oh, well, you know, it's all there. What makes it important to you to actually have that physical piece that somebody can pick up and read?
Oh, it's important to me. As a reader, I fell in love with books, the physical artifact of books, and I'm also a publisher. I run a small press called New American Press with some friends of mine, and we're always talking about moving to digital reading because the world wants to read on their Kindles, and I understand that. But for me as a reader, there's a very tactile experience that goes along with reading, and there's a kind of isolation or an aloneness that I really enjoy when I read a book because it's not connected to, say, the internet. And so much of our experience now, I think, is mediated by the internet and is sort of colored by the dings of instant messengers or email alerts or something. And part of the experience of reading for me is being away from some of that.
And Ellen, for you?
I agree very much. It's that tactile feeling. I fell in love with books and reading and then writing. And I really like editing, you know, taking my work and editing it in by hand. And one of our Canadian writers, Margaret Atwood, says that your brain and eye actually work better when you're have a physical piece of paper in your hand. And the same with reading. I like to pick up, and as I said, this is radio, so I can't show you this. Some of these wonderful covers. You know, there's the fall one had a red chair against the background of one of the Great Lakes. And there's just a nice sense that you can pick up this book and take it out into the garden with you or wherever you are.
You know, the other thing, too, is I love the smell of books.
Mm.
I love to open up a book and stick my nose in it.
Yeah, very, very much. I like that, too. And I like the feel of the paper.
Yep.
And the print. And
I may be old and old-fashioned that way, and I'm certainly connected digitally probably way more than I want to be. And I love the internet, and I love what it does, but there's something about picking up a book.
That's great. That's good to hear people say that, because I think I like that feeling of books, and I hope that we can continue publishing like this.
Yeah, I hear people say that that books are going to be a thing of the past, that it's all going to be in a Kindle or on a laptop or an iPad or something, and I don't quite buy it. I think we'll continue to do new things with technology, and I think those technologies will present new ways and different levels of convenience when we deal with these things, but I think books are going to be around.
Well, I mean, look at what happened in the music industry. What's come back? Vinyl.
Right.
After, you know, in the 1980s, everybody said, vinyl's dead. You know, we're going to have CDs and then now MP3s and all digital files. And what's the biggest thing now? Vinyl.
It's warmer, Bonnie.
Yeah.
It is warmer. And books are warmer, too.
And books are warmer. There's a certain, there's a certain ineffable thing, you know. So tell me about this tour. Now, not only are you publishing the review, but now you're going city to city to city. You're actually, speaking of music, it's like a band going on tour.
Right, it is. I think that's the image. And I also think there's a revival in reading aloud, reading poetry aloud, reading prose aloud. You get an immediate connection. And often I'll go to a reading and hear someone read, and then I'll want to go out and buy their book because, oh, yeah, that was great, and I heard it in the writer's voice. So I think hopefully this will help people understand more about what we're doing with this magazine.
So how is the tour schedule? I mean, are you doing local writers in each place with some other writers? How is it happening?
That's exactly how it's happening. I think Rob Jackson is traveling with three or four guys. Ellen, do you know who Rob's going around on tour with?
I actually don't know who he's on tour with. I say, I'm going to be in Chicago, so I'm the Canadian representative in Chicago. And then a few of our Hamilton writers are also reading in Toronto. I don't think anyone's going to Buffalo, as far as I know.
Yeah, so I think Rob Jackson and three or four other folks are heading city to city because there's going to be a reading every night beginning, I think, Sunday the 27th.
Now, are the local writers in each place, have they been published in the review, or is that not a requirement?
Yes.
They have been.
Yes.
They have been, or they will be. Their work is accepted for publication, or it's actually in this new issue that we'll be promoting at these reading events.
What do you hope that audiences take away from the great tour?
Energy, joy, celebration. I think it's I hope they get excited about the project. I hope they get hungry to participate as readers, as writers.
Is it an open submission or do you?
Yes.
Okay.
So, yeah, we'd like to really encourage people. Hopefully the writers and in the communities will come out and learn about this. I think this is a wonderful, it seems a very open place to submit. because really there's a lot of freedom. There aren't a lot of requirements about line lengths or forms or styles. It's very open.
Well, and as Ellen pointed out, we do big issues. I think this new issue is over 300 pages, actually.
That's right. So that's, again, really nice to have. It's like buying a book, you know, a whole book for each issue.
Yeah,
and so when you have a big issue, you have a wide range. It's, you know, and you can dip into it and read this and read that, and it's lovely.
And I think there's a sense of inclusion.
Very much.
So I hope people get excited about the project, and I hope they get excited about other reading and writing projects, too. I'm guessing that folks who come out to some of these events are going to have some of their own projects, and we're going to learn about those. And I hope that there's room for maybe future collaboration between some of these groups that are doing different things.
That's a really good point, David. And I think it's also good to show that things can be done. You can have an idea, and then it can happen.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Writers, it's really important to encourage both writing and reading. It's a kind of way of helping people express their own thinking, again, in an age when we get so much mass communication.
Well, and I think so much time, you know, and I was talking before about my experience of reading being sort of in seclusion and that being part of what I enjoy about it. But I tend to think of reading and writing as team sports, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that we do together as communities, as groups of friends. And I think projects like this maybe underscore that.
That's right. I'm just opening the first poem in what the previous issue was called A Movable Feast, and it's kind of that's what we're providing for people. I think a movable feast of words and ideas and feelings.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with it. Ellen and David, thank you so much for talking with me about it this morning.
Thank you again, Bonnie, for having us, and thank you, Ellen, for joining us. This has been great.
Thanks so much, Bonnie, for having us participate. And thanks, David. It's great to meet you on the radio, and I hope to meet you in person. And Bonnie, too.
Me, too.
Well, I'm hoping you're going to leave us with some form of writing. Ellen, do you have a poem or something?
I do. I have a poem that's published in the new issue by Kateri Lalbier, and she's a Toronto poet who'll be reading in Toronto. It's called Merrily, 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 Merrily. And listen for they play on words in the first line. I'm stamen stained and pistol whipped, forced to bloom by heart. Let's sew your shadow back on in the situation room. I magicked you out of the morning roar. I sang you out of my hair. All this time, I've only known you by your nom de guerre. Your story has gone viral. An epic lie, pandemic. We had to go extra innings in an overlit diamond ring. A babyless bathwater moon over the silver, burnt-out dollar room. How that a life was but a flower. You knew me by my petals. Give me your educated guess. I feel embedded in ice. All thoughts, all pleasures, all delights must end in freezing rain. Not for all the tea in teacher, all the harm in charm. I can't get warm this year, so I must wear the living room. Last laugh to the laugh track that will outlast us all. My red lipstick, safety feature, sign of poison, bullseye.
David Bowen and Ellen Jaffe are contributing editors to the literary magazine Great Lakes Review. Bowen is based in Milwaukee, Jaffe in Hamilton, Ontario. They spoke with Bonnie North. The Great Lakes Review's summer reading tour arrives in Milwaukee on Monday. Among the readers at the Art Bar that evening will be Dasha Kelly, Jeff Ponyevash, and former Lake Effect contributor Ed Mikowski. There's a link to more from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Parenthood has its challenges anywhere, but for the characters in the Minnesota North Woods of Rebecca Rasmussen's new novel, there are some especially heart-wrenching issues to deal with. We'll hear about Evergreen when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. The North Woods, for many of us, are a place to get away for a while, maybe recharge before returning to the rat race of city life. For the characters in Wisconsin native Rebecca Rasmussen's new novel, the North Woods are part and parcel of their life. Evergreen tells the story of three generations who are connected to a remote community of sorts in northern Minnesota. As the book opens, the character Eveline moves to the wilderness with her husband, Emil. But the two are separated shortly after their son is born, and the next 40 years are defined by love and separation in many incarnations. And the book explores when it's right to hold on to things and people and when to let go. Rebecca Rasmussen is back in Wisconsin for a few days, and she joins us in the studio now. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really wonderful to be back.
It is really wonderful to have you here. How much of Evergreen, both as a setting and maybe as a feeling, was inspired by your own time in the Northwoods?
Oh my gosh, so much of it. It's funny because this book isn't autobiographical in any sort of real way where you can say this date happened and this happened in my family, or, you know, like The Bird Sisters, my first novel, things were from my grandmother's journals. But this one is definitely like the heart of me. My summers up north in northern Wisconsin around Eagle River shaped absolutely who I am. And I kept missing the Northwoods because I live out in LA right now while my husband goes to school. And I kept being drawn back and back and back to the woods and the smells and the sounds. And maybe that's because I live right next to a highway and I'm forced to go back there. But everything, it just comes from, you know, a true love of the Northwoods and a wish always to be back there.
You mentioned the smells, and I don't know if there's a specific point in this book where we read about the smells. Maybe there is. But you really do get a palpable sense of what this rustic cabin, you know, free from electricity, is is really like.
Yeah, I think that it took a while sitting in my desk to really remember that. But I think there's some advantages actually to not living in the place that I'm writing about, because it forces you to sort of cull through your memories in a different way than when I'm experiencing them. And firsthand, just driving from Minneapolis to Milwaukee today, I sort of understood, oh, this is what I've been writing about, but it lacks that when you're sitting really thinking about something with a little bit of sentimentality that draws up those words in such a fun way.
And I don't know if this was your experience. We were talking a little before we turned the microphones on about our respective cabins and experiences, but the feeling that always appeals to me is that after 2 or 3 or maybe 4 days, there comes a point at which you lose the ability to tell when you're inside and when you're outside from any kind of climate control standpoint. You are just part of the environment, and the cabin is really, you know, despite having walls and doors and windows, is really not dissimilar from what's outside.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's what I fall in love with every time I get to go to a rustic cabin, I guess anywhere even. I'll take one anywhere. I love cabins. But I think it's that disconnecting from all of the things that keep us so busy and keep us away from the people we love the most, and really focusing on, you know, the beauty of a flower or the beauty of a big mosquito midsummer, just smacking it right on your skin.
Well, and there is that kind of mythology many of us, especially in the city, have with what life would be like in the North Woods. Mm. But for the character at the center, or the center of the beginning of this novel, she goes there not necessarily in search of an ideal, but for the sake of love, which I guess is maybe its own ideal.
Yeah, but she's definitely, you're right, she's not prepared for the wilderness at all. And she's not going there the way that, you're right, that sort of modern mentality, like escape our hectic lives in the city and go north, which, of course, when people do that, they often come right back because it's a little bit too wild for them. But Eveline, the story begins in 1938. So it's really a different kind of wilderness. You know, there's nothing there. There's not even a town. It's not yet called Evergreen, which is, you know, of course, the title of the book. So she's going there, yeah, because she has just been married, and she's married for love, which is a little unusual. At that time, it's a little practical, you know, impractical when everybody else is saying she should marry, you know, the fisherman who leaves buckets of fish on her doorstep. So she is going out into the wilderness, and she has the ideals of a young girl who is in love. So she's, you know, on the day that she arrives, she's wearing, you know, a summer dress and not prepared at all for what is to come. And the story really is about her sort of hardening and learning to find her way in a very difficult place.
And you were going to set the stage for us a little bit with just the first couple of paragraphs from this novel.
Yeah, this is the very opening of the novel, and I always think it's a good place to begin because then you can get a sense of the kind of place I'm writing about. So it starts with the character I just talked about, Eveline LeMay. Eveline LeMay came after the water. She arrived on a cool morning in early September, asleep in a rowboat without paddles, as if she knew the river currents would carry her past the tamarack and black spruce forest, around Bone Island, a fen, and a bog, all the way to Evergreen and her new husband, Emil, who was waiting for her on the rocky shore. The flood had delayed Eveline's trip north 2 months and forced her to travel by boat since the dirt roads had been washed away and no plans were made to restore them. Emil had sent word for her via the Forest Service to stay with her parents in Yellow Falls, a lumber town 20 miles south of Evergreen, until the water receded because he was living on the roof of their cabin, subsisting on whatever happened to float by. The newspapers blamed the flood on nature, but everyone knew the government had been building a dam to harness the power of the Snake and Owl Rivers in order to, in their words, bring light to all that was dark, but in everyone else's, to build a paper mill and clear-cut the forests.
Rebecca Rasmussen reading the opening to Evergreen. There are three generations that populate this book, and how we move from one to the next is part of the beauty of your writing that people probably ought to discover for themselves. But there are some recurring themes that many of the characters grapple with. What were the issues you most wanted to portray throughout this book?
I'm always interested in something that seems so simple, which is love, right? That's the catch-all for everything. But I'm interested in how people also cope with sort of the hands that they're dealt. And even if that hand is a bad one, or even in this case in the book, you know, there's a violent scene actually that a character has to really try to overcome. But I see that happening all around in the world today, where I live, where I've lived in the past. And I'm always interested, what do we do? How can we make the best of what happens to us, even if it doesn't seem fair at all and it's, you know, cruel or unusual? How does love kind of conquer all? Because I still believe that. I really do. I do.
The nature of choices really is at the heart of so much of this. And one of the things I was struck with was how much more impossible the women's choices in the book are than the men's. I mean, the men you write about, and I want to talk about this a little as well, are really, many of them, with some key exceptions, are heroic. But there are some almost impossible choices that first Eveline and later Nama, her daughter, are forced to make. You are a mom. Did you get to thinking about the position mothers are in when it comes to choices, maybe between themselves and their offspring?
Absolutely. And I absolutely was thinking about my grandmother and her parents both passed away when she was really little. And so that, you know, sort of started to get me thinking about motherhood initially several years ago. But then becoming a mother, yeah, you know, it's interesting because even though I don't know if I would make the same choices that the characters made, because I've been fortunate enough not to be put in such a difficult position. But I was thinking about, you know, the people who are abandoned or do not have that mother presence in their life. It haunts them forever. It doesn't matter how many people love them and how well they are loved, it still haunts them. And that's interesting to me, the ways in which through generations, one person's actions can kind of change the history of a family. So that's me.
Well, and at the heart of that is Nama, who Eveline's daughter, who was raised in an orphanage.
Yes.
And I gather, while this is obviously not your experience, her harsh reality there is not dissimilar from what orphanages were really like in that place and time.
Yeah, you know, people call that the gloomy part of the book. It's a, you know, but it's the truth. And I think that's what I was really interested in capturing, that, you know, it wasn't not every orphanage. I'm sure there's one out there that's really lovely. but a lot of them, there were, even if there was an outright brutality, there was just a lot of, you know, religious overtones and a lot of, you know, lack of actual physical touch and love in a positive way for children.
Love as we think of it in its ideal is not the love that was
right.
passed along at an orphanage like this.
Yeah, and this orphanage, I mean, I think the person who's in charge of it, her name is Sister Cordelia, and I think in her own broken way, she does love Nama, but she's broken herself and I don't think knows how to cope with her belief in God and the children and, you know, the behaviors of children in a small space with so many of them.
Maybe this is sort of a superficial question, but where did you come across the name Nama? It has, if the book is to be believed, a remarkable double meaning that, of course, is perfectly suited to who this character is.
I came up with it. I was just trying to figure out if I could come up with a name that meant something important to me, but also was not one that had been used that I had heard of. So the very significance of it now is sort of, it's been so long since I've written the book that people were asking me that the other night at a reading. I said, oh my goodness, I don't know if I can remember all the details of it. I just clicked with it because it was so unusual. And she's such a special character to me that I didn't want her to just have, you know, an ordinary name. Ordinary names are nice, though, in real life.
Says Rebecca Rasmussen. So I was struck by the heroic lengths the men throughout your book, with one key exception, go to be there for the women, both old and young. It is not always a side of men that is represented that way.
Yeah, one of the main characters is Hux. He has the big section, and he is Nama's brother, and he goes to very great lengths to try to heal the things that are broken, you know, from her childhood and her, and try to instill in her a sense of love and goodness. And he has, a reviewer said it, he doesn't have a mean or bad bone in his body. He really doesn't. That doesn't make him disinteresting to me, though. That makes him also really special. I have a brother, an older brother. His name is Eric, and he's very much the model for that character because he has real goodness in very difficult situations. And, of course, I look up to him very much as a big brother. But I think you're right. They don't really – there's not a lot out there of really just good-hearted men really doing their very best to help and save the women around them. You definitely see sort of the men straying in books, the men – doing something bad, very bad. But these guys are very good.
Well, right. We meet Hux, and we also meet his good and really only close friend Gunther, who lives across the river or the stream. And you know, we're kind of maybe ambivalent about Gunther, but he really also proves to be a pretty winning character.
Yeah, Gunther. You know, he's a little ridiculous. He's a Gunther, born with a gun in his hand. Like, he gets the name because he's just that rough and tumble kind of guy. He'll tackle you in the middle of just nowhere, just standing there. And he's always giving Hux a hard time, kind of like an older brother would, you know, wrestling him down, that kind of stuff. But he's gruff and he's very rough around the edges. But again, I think he really softens up, and he has a lot of growth for me towards the end of the book when he has to take on some sort of fatherly responsibilities that he hasn't before. Their protective gene is really strong up in Evergreen.
And the men are survivors in maybe a different but also sometimes a similar way to the women in the story. And I was also struck by the parallel friendships between Hux and Gunther, and also by Eveline and Lulu.
Yeah, I love the parallel there, and I didn't really realize it again until, you know, when you read reviews, you're saying, oh, that's what the book is really about, isn't it? But I also, the friendship between the women is so integral for me for the story to even happen. Once that happened, once I wrote Lulu's character into the book, I thought, this is the saving grace, these friendships, that sense of rescue that comes from friendships in the book.
How hard was it to tell this story as the generations progressed? We learn the stories of the characters in real time, but then kind of get the rest of their stories in retrospect when we jump forward in time.
It was really difficult, but one of the most difficult things was simply to let them go. So letting the first characters, Eveline and Lulu, and the whole sort of homesteading group go and moving on from them and just having them in recollection felt very sad for me. So I was kind of mourning the loss at each section. I think by the last section, when we get this sort of hopeful little voice from a little girl, I was so excited because I felt like it was all coming together. So then it didn't seem difficult. But the middle, you know, in the middle of a novel, you kind of can muddle through. That's a tricky territory. You start to go down roads and you have to pull yourself back. No, bad road. Don't do it.
Of course, letting go, knowing when to hold on and knowing when to let go, is also a very central theme to the book.
Yeah, and I wonder how that made it into the book.
What do you see as the overarching maybe similarity between this book and your last book, The Bird Sisters?
I think the overarching similarity, and I think What I would like people to say is that this girl has a lot of heart when she's writing these books. These characters, I think a lot of people like to call them character-driven novels. I don't really understand how a novel can be anything other than that. But the characters, to me, even though they're different people, they have the same sense of goodness in them, the same sense that, you know, if you're good, good things should happen to you, but they don't. So what do you do? How do you cope with that? That sense of survival, they can get a little scrappy at times too. But it's that heart. Like they're on the cover of the book, there's a broken heart among evergreen trees and a bird and a cabin. But that broken heart, for me, it's not broken. You know, it comes together. But that's the sense of it. I thought this is such a great cover for me because it really does just put out the heart of the book. And so I would say that. At the risk of being sentimental, but, you know, it really is. I think these characters, I always hope that they really live long in your, you know, sort of reader's mind after you're done.
They will absolutely stay with me for a long time. Rebecca Rasmussen, thanks so much. Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rebecca Rasmussen's new novel is called Evergreen, published by Knopf. Rasmussen grew up in Spring Green, but now lives in California, where she teaches at UCLA. She was in Oconomowoc last night for a reading at Books & Company, and will talk tonight at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. Parenthood and parental love are at the heart of Rebecca Rasmussen's novel we just heard about. In fact, the male characters in the book are practically heroic in places. Lake Effect essayist Lane Pierce recognizes that characteristic in her husband as well.
When I was pregnant with my son, I was lucky enough to work with many new moms. We would take short breaks to grab a cup of joe, in my case decaf, and I would ask countless questions about what was to come. One afternoon, the subject of fatherhood came up. I had thought about what my husband would be like as a father. Simply put, great. But I still knew to a certain degree it would be a wait-and-see game. How do you predict someone's response to a life-altering change? Something like parenthood can open you up and shut you down, all at the same time. My colleagues were laughing at some of the mistakes their partners had made in the early days. Backwards diapers, mismatched outfits. Then one of the women said to me, "But seriously, when the baby comes, don't be surprised if you want to divorce your husband or kill him. It's totally normal." When our baby boy did arrive, both my husband and I were filled with overwhelming joy and love. I think my friends had prepared me well. I expected the crying, the tears. I just hadn't expected them to be my husband's. He loved our child so much, his eyes burst with water around the clock. Within 12 hours of the delivery, I was rocking my baby in one arm and patting my husband's back with the other as he would stare at our son, murmuring how beautiful he was, the tears streaming down his beard. When he would hold our swaddled son, the drops would fall, splashing on his little face. At one point, I carefully removed the baby from my husband's arm so he wouldn't drown. The first moments of fatherhood brought out a tenderness in my husband that I have since seen many times. This summer, we celebrated his third Father's Day. My friend was right. Over the past 2.5 years, there have been moments when I wanted to kill him, but it's always his tenderness that stops me from going through with it. One of those moments came this week. For as long as I can remember, my 6'3", strong husband has had a weak stomach. While others might wrinkle their nose at unseemly things, my husband will respond with a full-out gag. Stinky garbage in the can? Gag. A little hair in the shower drain? Gag. Roadkill, mold, feminine products? Gag, gag, gag. I can't tell you how many times I've heard the familiar stifled cough as he cleans the contents of our son's diapers. So it was no small act of love when he took the night shift during our 2-year-old's bout with the stomach flu. After a long day of work for my husband and a near 24-hour nursing shift for me, we collapsed into bed and slept, only to be awakened a few hours later by the little voice next door. Mama, Daddy. I nudged my husband, mumbling something about gender equality, and he was halfway across the room when the cries became more urgent. My tummy hurts! Then the first gurglings of a very sick child. When I made it to the doorway, I saw my husband carry our sick little boy into the bathroom, vomit covering him from his earlobe down. Our little guy sobbed in between retches. I'm sick on Daddy. It's okay, my husband cooed, holding our little one. Just let it all out, buddy. It's okay. He sat there, rocking, rubbing our little boy's back, a strong stomach, and a tender heart.
Lake Effect essayist Lane Pierce is a Listen to Your Mother essayist and 2014 Milwaukee cast member. She writes, wrangles, and raises a toddler with her husband in Whitefish Bay. That's the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, a new report on the state of nonprofits and their health in the Milwaukee region. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I do hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're your NPR station in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Coming your way at 12 noon today from WBUR in Boston and NPR, it's Here and Now. But right now, it's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.